Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Today's guest, Carl Palmberg, from Sunlight and Rain Grass-Fed Beef, is a man whose life has been shaped by service, first in the Air Force, flying F-16s, and now on the family farm, where he's building a legacy of regenerative agriculture. Carl's story is a powerful reminder that the transition from military service to farming isn't just about changing careers. It's about finding a calling that brings deep satisfaction and a sense of duty to something greater than oneself. As Carl puts it, quote, "Being able to figure out how to feed people nutritious food gives a lot of job satisfaction, whereas some of my peers end up doing other jobs that pay a lot more, but don't have that same kind of sense of meaning and purpose. And if I had to choose one, I would choose the one that I have right now," end quote. Have a listen as we dive into Carl's story, his intentional approach to farming and grazing, and the lessons he's learned along the way about purpose, service, and the enduring connection between veterans and the land.
My dad and his family moved onto the farm in the spring of 1938 when he was 5 years old. So our family has been on that plot for a while. And my dad was in the military as well. So he was 3 months short of 40 years total time that he spent in the military, most of it in the Guard and Reserve, bouncing between the Army and the Air Force, mostly in the Air Force. And he flew his whole career. The majority of the time that he flew was fixed wing, but he also flew quite a bit of helicopters when he was in the Army Guard. He flew fighter jets, the Century Series fighters, F-100s, F-102s, and C-131, which is kind of a personnel transport plane, and then Huey helicopters. And he flew an L-19, which is like a souped-up Piper Cub, as an artillery spotter in the Army Guard. And that's what he used to commute from Sioux Falls up to Minneapolis when he was dating my mom. So he actually kept the airplane on our farm, built a hangar on our farm and would land in the sheep pasture. And when he was done with chores for the day, if he had extra time, he'd go up and log an additional flying training period and terrorize the neighbors and things like that. Back it was pretty cowboyish with the rules. So that's kind of fun history there. And so I grew up farming. I was fortunate that when I was about 13 or 14, my dad started to slow down on his farming career and sold off a lot of our cows. We had about 180 mama cows, and he sold down to about 13 of the best first calf heifers. And we put a bunch of our ground in the Conservation Reserve program at that time. Mm. And he allowed me to buy into half of the herd at that time. So I took kind of a personal loan out to him for 6.5 of those heifers. And then he and I worked together to build our herd back up from that while I was in junior high and high school, which was an amazing experience and opportunity that my dad and my mom afforded me. Then I went to college, South Dakota State University, just about an hour up the road, studied engineering and did Air Force ROTC. I was able to get an eyesight waiver to obtain a pilot training spot in the Air Force. So after graduating from South Dakota State in the year 2000, I went to undergraduate pilot training and on from there with a career in the Air Force of flying F-16s. I was on active duty for about 12 years from 2000 to 2012, and then transitioned back to Sioux Falls to the Air National Guard. And I came back to the Air Guard as a part-time guardsman and started farming again with our family farm here. My dad still being fully retired or almost fully retired and helping me out quite a bit. And we remodeled a house and spent another 11 years in the Air National Guard, before retiring in 2023. And so now I have a more of a singularity of focus on being able to concentrate on the family farm more. Wow.
It's super uncommon to hear, and maybe this is just the difference in time here, where you've got sort of single pilots who do both helicopters and fixed wing, but also just such a variety of fixed wing. I mean, C-130s
yes.
all the way down to fighter jets. From what he's told you about that time, was that unusual to have such a broad breadth of platform capabilities?
Well, we were, and it was a C-131, so it was even way prior to the C-130s. So
okay.
Air 440, it looked like a DC-3.
okay.
You know, and he would fly the governor around and things like that. And so in that day, I mean, the acquisitions process was just a lot faster in the military. You know, we were going through the Century Series fighters. You get a new fighter every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And so there was just a lot more movement of learning new aircraft and new airframes. The bouncing back and forth between the Army and the Air Guard, that was probably still pretty unique. And then, you know, going between fixed wing and rotary wing was unique even then. I mean, it'd be almost unheard of now. But yeah, that was...
I mean, I can imagine it's like driving a moped or driving a sports car, right? I mean, they just don't operate the same way.
Right. Right. Yep. Yeah.
Were you old enough at that time to remember a lot of that sort of cowboy aviation where your dad would fly into the farm and hop off and take you up sometimes, or was it not quite that cowboy?
That was way before my time. So my dad was 42 or 43 when I was born. He was ending his fighter career, and in the Air National Guard, when you turned 50, you could no longer fly in the Air National Guard. And so he transitioned from fighters to the C-131, that transport, when I was in grade school. So I remember my first recollection of him in aviation is flying that transport. Okay. And that was, so I didn't see him like buzz the farm or anything like that. He did take two of my sisters. My sisters are like 10 years older than I am. He took one of their senior classes for a ride in that airplane. And I was able to like smuggle myself onto the airplane. So I got to ride in that airplane, which was kind of fun. And then he transitioned after he was 50, from when he was 50 until when he was 60, to back into the Army Guard in Rapid City, South Dakota, and flew Huey helicopters and some fixed wing Cessnas there, doing you know, Army Guard stuff, as well as spotting for marijuana in people's fields and things like that.
Oh my gosh. But
things were settled down then enough to where I was no longer able to like jump into a helicopter with them. Even days when they would do spouse flights and they would fly their spouses, my mom offered to let me take her spot, but they wouldn't let that happen. So
he was still flying for the Guard from his 50s into maybe his early 60s. Hilo?
Yes. Yeah. He
joined
Army Guard again when he was 60 or 50, and he flew the Hueys, I think, for about 5 or 6 years. And then he transitioned into a Cessna 310, 310 primarily for the last like maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Is he still with us?
No, he died in January of last year, 2024, when he was 91 years old.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Was he still flying privately prior to that?
We bought a Cessna 182 when he joined the Army Guard out in Rapid City to help him commute out there. Mm-hmm. And we kept that airplane around for years and years. And so I flew it with him and things like that. And his last landing that he landed in the left seat, I was in the right seat, was when he was 83.
Wow. So was it, I mean, can you remember a time when you were growing up where you didn't want to fly? Like, was that pretty much sort of in your blood at that point? Like, I'm going to go be a pilot.
It was in my blood. My folks were generous, and they paid for me to get my pilot's license when I was the summer that I turned 17. So for some reason, 17 is the age instead of 16. It was at that time for getting your license. You could solo prior to that, but you couldn't get your license. Huh. And so I took lessons all through that summer and then got my license that fall. I skipped school one day to go take my check ride and got my license. And so I flew our 182 all around and rented some airplanes and flew. So I was airborne a lot from an early age. And I really did desire to fly and to fly fighters. And looking back on it now, I realize, I think, that my desire to fly fighters was mostly a desire to do something intense and challenging and probably unusual. And that was one of the biggest reasons that I wanted to fly the F-16 is that with that particular airplane, you know, with the bubble canopy and the ergonomics of that airplane, you feel like you're kind of wearing the airplane a bit more. And it's kind of a pilot's airplane. And so that that really appealed to me. And the challenge of doing difficult things in the air really appealed to me. I know now that some people have a real love for aviation. You know, they're flying every chance they get. That's kind of worn off for me now. And I never really did, I think, have the strict love of flying like a lot of people do. But I really had that desire for something intense and challenging. And I found that most in the air.
Do you still have a pilot's license, a private pilot's license?
I do, I suppose, technically. But I haven't flown since my last flight, my Finney flight in the F-16 in August 8th of 2023. Okay. I had my last flight and I retired and I haven't flown since then.
Okay. Being that you were kind of your formidable years at the time your dad was flying helos, not fixed wing, was there this sort of internal battle between, man, I know I want to go fast and flip upside down in the fixed wing, but I have these like tangible memories of rotary wing with my dad at that age. Like, was that a big decision or a tough decision to make? Or was it like, I'm not even going to consider flying helos. I'm going to go straight to fixed wing.
Well, I had a snowmobile growing up. Answer your question, but I had this little snowmobile that my folks bought. And during the winter, I just lived on that thing. I loved riding the snowmobile around, jumping terraces. And I just got to know that thing like the back of my hand. And it just felt like I was wearing a glove. I could flip it up on one ski and then the other ski. And what I desired was to have an experience in the air similar to the experience that I was feeling on that snowmobile. And I felt like flying fighters would be the closest thing that I would have to that. Helos, or maybe something like a C-130 or a C-17 doing nap of the earth stuff would maybe be the next closest thing to that. But that's kind of the reason that I chose a little bit to go towards that path. Although I had poor eyesight. So I wore glasses from a fairly early age and my prescription was getting stronger and stronger. And by the time I got into college, my eyesight was well beyond the limits of anything in military aviation that would allow that. And so I felt kind of a patriotic duty to my country. And so I loved farming. I loved building things. I decided I wanted to go through kind of an engineering route and wanted to go through the military, get my education, spend 3, 4, or 5 years in the military, kind of do my patriotic duty, check that card or whatever, and then come back to the farm and farm. When the possibility came up to get a waiver for the eyesight requirement that would allow me to apply for a pilot training spot, I just felt like that was a tremendous opportunity that I couldn't pass up, and it'd be really cool. And so I went down that route. And so that's what kind of drove me. But it wasn't like I had that as my sole desire the whole way through high school and college. It was kind of an opportunistic thing that came along.
You said you graduated South Dakota State in the year 2000?
Yes.
So you would have been in pilot training during 9/11?
Yes, I was in undergraduate pilot training when 9/11 happened.
What was that like?
I heard about the attacks on the radio as I was driving into Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. I was in the beginning stages of pilot training, so I was flying the T-37 Tweet. So it took longer to get through the gate that morning. Then we went into our kind of our classroom where our flight of about 25 guys usually got together, where we'd study, we'd do a lot of our briefings and things like that there. And all the TVs in the whole building are on, watching the Twin Towers burn and things like that. And we're all just watching like, holy cow, you know, where are we going? You know, sign me up, we're going. And so we watched the goings on there for an hour or two. And then I just remember the captain that was in charge of our flight. Finally, he just walked up, shut off the TV, and he said, boys, it's time to get to work.
So you had a couple of years of training left at that point. Where was your first duty station?
My first combat duty station was in Kunsan, South Korea.
Okay. Maybe talk us through some of those deployments and whether or not any of them ended up in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan.
Sure. So while I was in South Korea, you really don't deploy a whole lot from there. That was where it was a great place to be. If you know anything about fighter aviation, and specifically F-16 aviation, going to Kunsan is kind of a little bit of a rite of passage. And so it was great to go there as a young guy. We call them punks, the lieutenants and captains, and and cut my teeth kind of in the fighter community there.
So why is it such a rite of passage? Because it's a difficult place to fly?
It's a fairly difficult place to fly. The weather is horrible there.
Okay.
My first flight there, the weather was too bad for me to fly solo, actually, for the first flight. They required the weather to be fairly good for you, the first flight on the rock, they call it, to fly solo. And so I actually had to have my instructor in the back seat of a two-seater, which is a big bummer when you're an pilot, you know, single-seat aircraft. You don't want anybody sitting in your back seat. But he sat in the back seat. We went out and did maneuvers and things like that. And I had learned to fly the F-16 in Phoenix, Arizona, where the weather is like beautiful all the time. And everybody in Kunsan was used to horrible weather. And we came back and we shot an instrument approach. And I got to my minimums of that instrument approach, and I did not see the runway environment. And so I went around. And so we started to divert to an alternate field. And as we were on our way to that divert field, that field shut down because its weather was too bad. And I was like, holy smokes, what are we going to, you know, do?
I guess.
So yeah, we turned the airplane around, came back to Kunsan. And I'm just thinking in my head, you know, you always hear about these mishaps and how they go through the lessons learned. And it was like, okay, mishap pilot number one and mishap pilot number two, they turned around from their divert decision to come back to Kunsan. And so we shot the approach again. I think it went missed approach again. And now we're getting low on fuel, like really low on fuel. So my instructor in the back seat has lower minimums for his approaches than I do. So he said, I'm going to fly the approach from the back seat. When you see the runway environment, let me know and you can take over and land the plane like right before we land. And so he started flying down to the minimums and we got to the minimums and we're like, okay, we're at the minimums now. And we had a crosswind. It was foggy and rainy. So I'm looking out kind of the side of the canopy because we're crabbing into the wind. And I was like, I got the runway. And so I took over at like 200 or 300 feet above the ground and went down and got the airplane on the ground somehow, landed. And then as soon as we landed and rolled out, like our canopy fogged up and I couldn't see a thing. And I didn't know the airfield very well. I didn't know where to taxi. I was completely disoriented and lost. And he got us taxied back to the ramp. And then they do what's called hot pit refueling, where you can just keep the airplane running and they fill up the airplane with fuel. And we hot pitted and then took off again. I could not believe it. I was like, oh man, I really got to get my stuff in line here because this is going to be an intense year. And it was a good year for camaraderie within the Air Force community. One of my squadron mates ended up being my future brother-in-law. That's how I met my wife, was through him.
Awesome.
So I spent about a year and a quarter in Kunsan, and then went to Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks, Alaska. And so I spent almost 3 years there, So I upgraded to flight lead and instructor pilot up in Fairbanks. And while I was there, we had an upgrade to our aircraft that happened, which caused them to be not flyable for a period of time. And so another guy and I got farmed out to a guard unit from Toledo, Ohio, for a little while and deployed with them. So they were short on guys to go on a deployment to Iraq. So I went to Toledo, flew a few spin-up rides with them, and got to know them and their aircraft a little bit, and then went with them to Balad Air Base in Iraq.
Were you flying close air support for the Army or the Marines at that point?
Yep, that's all we were doing there. And it was pretty slow time there. We only had a few guys drop ordnance and things like that. So mostly just armed overwatch,
Okay.
giving guys heads up on things, taking a look with our targeting pods and things like that. So that was our time in Iraq.
And then from there?
From Alaska, then I moved back to Phoenix, Arizona, and went to Luke Air Force Base as an instructor. So I instructed young guys in the B course learning to fly the F-16, and then I transitioned into a foreign military sales squadron at Luke Air Force Base, instructing pilots from Taiwan. So that was a very interesting international experience. That's where I met my wife as well. So she was visiting her brother, my brother-in-law, and who was now stationed at Luke as well. So I met my wife, Carissa, while we were there and dated and got married while I was at Luke Air Force Base. About 3 months after we were married, I got a call on a Tuesday night that said from my squadron commander and said, "Hey, I lost kind of an arm wrestling match. We have the base had to send somebody on this deployment, and you were the one that was picked to go on a deployment, and you need to leave on Sunday for 6 months.
This is on
Plus,
a Tuesday.
after you do a month of training." So on, they wanted me to leave on Sunday. I said, I'm gonna leave on Sunday. I'm gonna go to church. I'm gonna leave on Monday." And then I went to Fort Dix in New Jersey for a month of Army training. And then I went to not Bagram, I went to Kabul, Camp Eggers in Afghanistan for 6 months. And I was just a single person augmentee to the Army to help advise the Afghan National Police on personnel issues. So completely
Whoa.
outside any
Whoa.
of my wheelhouses. So after a month or two, I got kind of settled into a specific job there of helping to orchestrate basically the counting of all the Afghan National Police, because we were paying all their salaries. And we were suspicious that their numbers that they said they had were not what they really had. And so it was my job to organize a personnel accountability line where little groups of folks from each province would go out and set up this little line where people would go through and they'd get their name and their family name and do a retinal scan and give them an ID card and things like that. So it
What
and
year was that?
that was in 2000, the end of 2010 to the beginning of 2011.
Okay. And this was, you were based out of Kabul doing this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's when I was in Afghanistan in Nawa. And I can remember we were fairly partnered as well, both with the police and the army. And when you did this, I remember that stupid little retina scan device, this biometric thing that you would have to use, and like I mean, it would sometimes work and sometimes not work. And we used it to try to find bad guys essentially that had been loaded into this database ahead of time. But I mean, just when you did that hand symbol, I went, I know, I remember what that thing is. But there was a big problem as well with like guys would. You have these sort of numbers of folks that were supposed to be at certain partnered positions, and sometimes there was like 30 or 35, and you end up having 10 or 12 show up. Then the holidays come rolling around, and you end up with six, for 6 weeks at a time. Like, what's going on here? But I didn't know that they had this kind of big concerted effort to try to put more granularity with it, even at the capital level.
Well, I would call it an effort, but I wouldn't call it a success. And so one of the biggest regrets, I guess, of my career was about maybe a month or two before I left. We had been training all these teams. They'd come in riding on donkeys from Badakhshan and stuff like that. And we're giving them computers and CDs and headlamps because the power always goes out, and outfitting these teams and really getting enthusiastic about that and sending them out. And then I started to go out to the provincial headquarters and visit these teams to see how things were going, to ensure that their leadership was giving them the support that they needed to get data. We started to get data back as some of these CDs started to come back into the capital. But as I started going out to the provincial headquarters, and they always kind of wine and dine you, you know, it's their culture. And then they would show me their personnel system. And it was a big dog-eared book full of, it looked like a huge scrapbook, you know. But that's how they kept track of things. And I just remember thinking, I was like, I think we are really forcing a square peg in a round hole here. And I started to see the writing on the wall in that regard. And I was tasked to give an update. This was one of General Petraeus's big priorities, is this PAI, Personnel Asset Inventory. And so you're the one in charge of it. You're going to brief Petraeus. So I put together a brief, and I briefed a colonel, and he told me to change these things. And then I'd brief a one star, and he'd tell me to change these things. And then I'd brief a two star, and he'd tell me to unchange the things that the colonel had told me to change. And all the way through until finally one night I'm sitting at like 7 o'clock at night across the desk from General Petraeus. And I would have gotten my head chopped off if I had done it, but I should have just leveled with him and said, look, these charts are showing all these green and yellow lights, no red lights on there. But this thing is going to fail, and it's not going to be giving you good information. It's not going to be lasting. And we are trying to force our kind of a system on these poor guys. I didn't say that. And I transitioned out. Another guy took my place. He was actually a personnel officer, which is great. He took my place and kind of took the program over from where I was at, going out to visit these different sites. And they ended up getting rolled up and blown up. And he got shot. But he got a purple heart out of the thing. And I have really felt bad about my contribution to what was probably a bad idea and ended up being dangerous for him.
Oh, because of the fact that it did require him to get out and go visit these different provincial headquarters, that's when they got injured. Yeah.
And that was kind of my own maybe bravado when I was doing it. I just was so ambitious, and I wanted to change Afghanistan in 6 months while I was there and stuff like that. And I'm like, and you know, something would happen and nobody else would want to travel outside the base. I'm like, come on guys, let's go. You know, if we're going to change this country, got to be aggressive and got to kind of lay it out on the line and let's do this. And I still like that attitude. But I should have been more eyes wide open and communicative with what I felt was the real story.
So you guys had like a few weeks of a turnover, right, before you left? And
probably a week, something like that.
I mean, were you candid with him and what you, the viability of what you thought this program was going to be?
I can't remember exactly what my words were to him, but I tried to be as truthful with him as I possibly could. And, you know, he came in with the same attitude that I was, like, let's get this thing done. And just he was a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Dang.
So.
And so you left to come.
Yeah. So I
back to Arizona 2011.
Yeah, went back to the 21st Fighter Squadron, the Taiwan Squadron, back to kind of my old job there. And did about, I think it was about a year there before I transitioned from there to the Air National Guard. And so it was perfect timing. I came up to the Air Guard here, moved up here in like March. So it was just in time for spring planting season. And I transitioned up here as a traditional guardsman. So just a part-time guardsman, working on the farm. We spent that first year living in my parents' basement, remodeling the house that I'm sitting in right now. And so a pretty intense year there. My wife was working as well before we started having a family. And then after I did the part-time guardsman, and then I would pick up full-time orders a lot of times in the wintertime. So flying the F-16s in Sioux Falls, we were also tasked with manning an alert facility in March Air Reserve Base in near San Diego. So one of Homeland Defense, you know, post 9/11 type stuff. And so we would go down there for a week at a time, get groceries, go into this alert facility and be sitting there with the F-16s ready to go. They're called hot cocked. Mm-hmm. And we're in our flight suits, just kind of hanging out, twiddling our thumbs, waiting for something to happen, which rarely did. We'd do a couple practice scrambles during the week to break up the monotony a little bit and keep on top of things. But I spent a lot of time in Southern California, a week at a time, stuck in that facility. But doing that allowed me to get full-time orders for like a month at a time. So I'd usually fill my winters a lot, especially before we had livestock, with sitting alert and getting some much-needed income and things like that. And then as time went on, I started to gradually slide into more of a leadership role in the Air National Guard as a squadron commander and then the inspector general for our unit. And so the last 5 years, I was full-time, active guard and reserve, full-time, and got me up to 20 active duty years. So 23 total years, but 20 years of full-time service.
You said that during part of that 2011 timeframe where you were in the sort of more traditional guard type role, you made a mention to the farm, right? So, I mean, before you went full time, if you will, in a more leadership role the last 5 years, what kind of work were you able to do on the farm and how had it changed from when you remember being there as a kid to, you know, 10, 12 years later?
Yeah. So in 2010, about 2 years before I moved back, I kind of made the decision, okay, I am going to get out. I'm not going to take the next assignment on active duty, and I'm going to transition back to the farm. That's when I let my dad know, hey, I'm coming back to the farm, which he was really pleased with. Let my parents know. And so I started farming from a distance, actually, those last 2 years. So I would take the leave that I had, and I would come home in the spring, and I would put the crop in. I would come home in the fall to either take the crop out or supervise the crop being taken out. In fact, when I got that short notice deployment to Afghanistan for 6 months, that meant I could not come home that spring. And my dad was at that point, I think, 78 years old, and he put the whole crop in for me.
Oh, my gosh.
He tilled and planted 350 acres of corn and soybeans for me at that time. And then when I transitioned back, actually being here, I took what I felt like the skill sets and the steps that I usually went through learning a new aircraft or learning a new weapon system, and just that process of learning the nomenclature, learning exactly how everything functions, and then learning how to employ that thing and work with it so that you can kind of take it apart, build it back again, and use it appropriately. I took that same mindset to farming and agriculture and agronomy at first. And so I literally went to like one of the best agronomists that I could find. And I just sat down in his office and I said, tell me how plants grow and tell me what organic matter is, you know, and just I could barely keep N, P, and K straight. You know, I was very low on the knowledge base because I grew up kind of as the hired man and doing things around the farm, but not really studying intellectually and understanding things. And, you know, our understanding of biology in the soil especially had come a long ways from when I grew up. And so that, along with the availability of the internet and all the information that comes from that, and time while sitting alert to research all these things, I really put myself through a complete new education and pivoted the farm 20 degrees at a time until we were almost 180 degrees from where we had originally been. year by year. And so, and it continues to be an evolution in how we're farming. And because of my kind of aggressive nature, I went after those things fairly aggressively, which has helped to move the ball down the road. But it has also been at times a financial struggle too, and also a struggle in just time and time management.
A lot of veterans that I get the chance to speak to talk about a transition process from active duty or even sometimes temporary military service into what in many cases isn't agriculture first, and then ends up becoming agriculture, where they find the sense of purpose again. From what you've described, it didn't seem like you had that sort of non-ag, if you will, transition. You somewhat, sounds like, knew at some point you were going to come back to the farm, and then it was just a matter of making it happen. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. Were there instances or time during your active duty service where you thought that maybe you weren't going to come back to the farm? Maybe you were going to go do something different?
I was undecided on exactly when and if I would come back to the farm until about that 2009-2010 timeframe, when I kind of failed at my pursuit of going to weapons school, which is like the Air Force version of Top Gun. Right. When it looked like my career path was not going to take me there, that is where I felt God kind of shutting the door on my desire to stay in the military for a full 20-year active duty career, and just reopen my eyes to the desire to be back on the farm and with family and that lifestyle, especially to raise a family, even though at that point I wasn't married and things like that. That's where I felt like that transition happened. And that transition, I remember, I think happened while I was in Iraq, because while I was in Iraq, I was taxiing out to a combat sortie, and on the radio, the operations desk let me know that they'd gotten a call somehow or an email of what my next assignment was. And my next assignment was back to Luke Air Force Base as an instructor, whereas my first choice was go to Shaw Air Force Base to fly Block 50 F-16s there. I felt like that would have been the best way, the best route for me to get to weapons school, but going to Luke Air Force Base was not as high of a hitter for being able to go to weapons school. That, along with the a sermon that I had heard in the chapel from a chaplain who actually had known my dad way back in the day. And I got to know him a little bit because we had a pilot there crash and die while we were there. So we had chaplains crawling all over us. Yeah. But I got to know this guy, and he gave a sermon about dogged determination and dog sleds, and kind of an Alaska sermon, as well as putting both hands to the plow, and the admonition that Christ gave to, you know, if you are looking back, like if you're holding a plow with both hands and you look back over your shoulder, kind of like you do if you have one hand on the wheel and you'll look back over your shoulder, you tend to veer a little bit. And that really, in service to God, you need to keep both hands on the plow, keep your eyes on the horizon, focus on that tree that's on the horizon, and make a nice straight line. And so at that point, I was like, all right, Lord, I'm going to put both hands to the plow, and whatever you have for me, I'm going to go at it in full afterburner, full grunt. And so That was where I feel like I made that transition on my taxi out for that.
No kidding.
So with that being said, I tried to go after everything, you know, my time in Afghanistan, everything like that, with all the bravado that I could. It almost killed me, it feels like, because in 2018, when we transitioned back to full-time active service in the Guard, I took a squadron command for the support squadron, kind of right next to the fighter squadron, the support squadron that had the life support folks and the intelligence folks and things like that. So a fairly small squadron, but squadron command nonetheless. We had two kids, and then we had twins, and we deployed to Afghanistan all in that same year. And that was like, thinking back on that, it just kind of it makes my stomach twist a little bit. Both my wife and I think about everything that we were doing there. We had gotten cattle again for the first time in 2016. So I was still kind of building out the infrastructure and things like that for having cattle. I replaced all the fences on the entire farm. And so that deployment to Afghanistan, I was really ill-prepared in the flying and just my mental attention. My primary focus, if I have to be honest mentally, was not in what I was doing. It was on the farm and what I was doing on the farm. So anyway, but I tried to still give full weight of effort as much as I consciously could in that job, as well as after getting tagged to be the inspector general, which nobody wants to do, but Correct. Do that well. And I did that as well as I could right up until the end. And so for that reason, you know, after my Finney flight, now people ask me if I miss the guard and stuff like that. And I miss the camaraderie. The people are great and things like that. But flying now, in my mind, unfortunately, is a little bit associated with that season of life of being completely overwhelmed. And that last couple years, my dad was in failing health. And so I was providing kind of CNA type care for him at home because he was able to stay at home the whole time. So that was another, a brick on the bridge or whatever. So
good night.
Yeah, it was intense. Now that we're transitioning, the military is no longer there. I can fully concentrate on the farm. I'm blessed in that, a lot of fighter pilots are like, oh, am I going to go to the airlines? What am I going to do when I grow up? And they just wish-wash for this for like 20 years. And I've never had to have that sort of odyssey in figuring out what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But the transition from full-time military service to zero military service, fully retired, was still a transition, more than I thought it would be. And more than I almost acknowledged it at the time. And I think it was more manifest by probably not being able to sleep very well for a little while, you know, waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning. I'd never had cold sores and my lips broke out in cold sores. And so there's just some physical manifestations there that made me finally have to acknowledge that, yeah, this is a stressful time, even though I don't know exactly why it should be, but it is just that big, big change, if nothing else, causes stress.
As you were coming out of your final flight in 2023,
mm-hmm.
or even before, but okay, so right after that. Yeah. While you were in Afghanistan, right before you guys, or right after you got cattle, your wife was then managing the farm and the cattle while you were deployed?
Let's see. While I was in Afghanistan, yeah. So my wife was here. I had, at that point, I had a neighbor that I had tasked with looking after my cattle at that time. Thankfully, a guy who was willing to do it. He didn't have any cattle. He grew up with cattle, so he knew cattle. I was doing rotational grazing at that time, and that was kind of new to him. And so, but he humored me and did the rotational grazing for me. And, but it was still a small handful. It was like, you know, 15, 20 animals or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, he took care of them for me.
I should have asked this earlier, before I forget. Are you far enough away from that stressful transition time to reflect back on what you thought was the sort of primary driver of why that was such a difficult time in light of the logic that it shouldn't have been?
Oh, the transition?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think it just such a huge change, you know, because my identity and my life's work or whatever for that 23 years had been focused on military aviation and always kind of looking at current events and the news with a little bit of the weight of the defense of America on my shoulders. And so I looked at everything through that lens, and then completely letting that go was just really a big change.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. That makes more sense now as to like, it's like going from 100 miles an hour to zero and then turning the car in a different direction, right? Like I remember coming home as well. And from Afghanistan in 2011, and it just takes time to sort of reset, right? I mean, there's always the sort of typical stories of like driving and seeing things on the side of the road or, you know, loud bangs at first that just take time to kind of transition away from. But that I say that to sort of give parallel to the fact that you're now operating in a different environment with a different set of glasses on, right? And that sounds a lot like where you were, different environment, different set of glasses, different focus. Some things that used to weigh heavily on you weren't weighing heavily on you anymore. But now you had this whole new thing now that you had to learn and then use as a element of providing for what sounds like was a growing family at the time. Yeah, that's tough in any respects.
Yeah. Where were you in Afghanistan in 2011?
Just east of Marja in Nawa. So Lashkargah.
Okay.
South of Lash.
Okay. Okay. So,
but it was very much a kind of partner development type role, right? Marja had just been cleared a year or two before that. And so you still had a lot of remnants of what was going on to the east of there. But then we had very much a build mission, right? So it was the green zone, right? Gosh, I forget what river that was that ran north-south. Anyway, major river north-south. So all the agriculture was right off the edge of that river. And therefore, all of the population center, air quotes, right? But a lot of the cities and villages were around that area. And so our job was to sort of take the Afghan army and the police and distribute them across this 350 square kilometer battle space in partnered positions as a company of 250 Marines. And try to hold it, right? Protect it, control it, and then begin to build some element of commerce back into it. So it was an interesting time.
Yeah.
But I've heard you talk about the farm with, you know, 350 acres of corn and soy. You've mentioned cattle at some point. You've mentioned rotational grazing. 350 acres of conventional corn and soy is much different than rotational grazing at start 15 or 20 head of cattle. How, why did you choose to make that decision from something that sounds fairly conventional to something that is fairly unconventional or was at the time?
So I started doing things exactly like I did when I grew up. So the first thing that I bought when I decided that I was going to farm was a John Deere 4640 tractor and a disc, and then a 7,000 planter, you know, like a 6-row or 4-row planter, corn planter. So a disc and a planter. And I was disking everything, planting. And then on my education, I started to learn and determine that one of the main factors for profitability on our farm is going to be the level of organic matter that we have. And I didn't know what organic matter was exactly. Not a lot of people do. And I didn't know how to get it, but most people said that you needed to decrease tillage in order to do that. And so I was firm enough on my knowledge of that I knew I needed to decrease tillage. So we figured out how to no-till soybeans into the corn, which my dad was like, that was completely different than anything he had growing up. Because for him, most of his farming career, the better the farmer that you were, the blacker the ground was when you planted.
Right.
And so, well, you know, no-tilling beans into corn stalks, you couldn't even tell where you'd been hardly, you know? And then I also built a strip tiller. So I would strip till the corn. And so we got, you know, RTK guidance on the tractors, you know, slapped it on all these 1970s tractors and did strip tilling with corn. Started to see pretty significant increase in water infiltration after large rain events, enough to make me really excited about that. And then I remember seeing my first like webinar or presentation by Gabe Brown in North. And some of this stuff, And I'd seen some other kind of regenerative agriculture stuff, but when I saw a guy in North Dakota doing these things, I thought, ah, maybe this could work here. And so I started to learn about the five, now six principles of soil health and animal integration, and learning about the influence of that. And that's really what spurred me towards, okay, let's get animals again. And a portion of our farm, at that time, about 600 acres, about 200 acres, 250 of it is pasture and hay ground, really not good for row cropping. And so it's just logical as I transitioned back into farming more and more that eventually I get livestock again.
So you started with that, with those acreage that weren't suitable for corn or soy or hay, and put the cows there first.
Yeah, I first bought like 13 cows, six bred cows, and seven yearling heifers. First year I had six calves. And I
Wow.
over a small 20-acre pasture that we had. The other like 150-acre pasture we continued to rent out for a couple more years until I had more cattle. But on that small 20-acre pasture, I bought some polywire and push-in posts and a little solar energizer and started doing rotational grazing.
What were everybody has this sort of beginning aha moment of when that sort of rotational effort begins to bear fruit. And there's an example I'll give you. A good friend of mine who has a program actually with the Naval Postgraduate School and the Army at Camp San Luis Obispo. He is so Eric Chaya is running a program out there called Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab, our goal. And he's got a couple of, have you heard of Eric before and what he's doing?
A little bit, yes.
Okay. So he's got, I think, several hundred cow-calf pairs, and it's on a fairly big chunk of land, at least a couple thousand acres. And he's rotationally grazing these animals, and he somehow convinced the two prior land lease owners or land lease operators that had been running cows on there before to try this weird rotational thing with this guy who was and still is a current active duty Army major to try this like rotational grazing thing. I don't know how he got him to do it, but he did. These guys had been farming this acreage for 30 years before, right? And they had never really seen any change in the wildlife outside of the cattle. It had always been sort of the struggle. And Eric said after the first 6 months, they had deer come back in numbers that they had never seen in 30 prior years. They had turkeys come back in droves. And he said that the prior producers said to him, "We've never seen this kind of ecological shift in such a short period of time in the last 30 years that we've been doing it. Like maybe there's something here, right?" Now, Eric is at a position now where a lot of other folks have begun to get the attention of what he's doing out there. Camp Roberts, which is 40,000 acres, an hour south or an hour north in Camp San Luis Obispo in California, are starting to notice. I mean,
Wow.
really, really interesting about taking this land that surrounds military bases, that's currently conventionally managed or not managed at all, and beginning to put livestock on there and rotationally graze them to improve fire or reduce fire load, improve soil quality with a host of other benefits, and potentially then use those cattle as a food source for the personnel on the base. But I'm curious from your experience as you started at 20 acres with a dozen or so head, if there were these sort of aha moments after a few months or maybe even a year where you said, ah, this is working the way that it's working. Were there any of those kind of strong salient points that stood out to you?
I would say the widespread improvement in the ground has been slower in coming than 6 months. I did
Okay.
grazing on that 20-acre pasture first, and now that pasture is rocking compared to what it was before. But the first thing that was really the thing that popped into my brain when you asked me that question was the corral on that 20-acre pasture was a corral that my dad and I built when I was in junior high or high school, put it together there. And when I came back, it had been, set stock grazed by a neighbor. And when I wanted to use the corral, I had to spend 2 or 3 hours hoeing off thistles in there because I couldn't even swing a gate. It was just solid thistles, like 6, 7 feet tall, big thistles. And so I chopped them all down and, worked the cattle or whatever. And after a couple years, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years of rotational grazing where cattle had access to that corral for a short period of time, but long rest periods, the grass in the catch pen of that corral was so thick and lush and free of thistles that my son and his puppy came out there and were walking around in it barefoot. And I just took a video of that because I was like, this is incredible. This is the same place that I just chopped solid thistles down. I haven't sprayed anything, and there are no thistles, and it's the most lush grass I can possibly imagine here. So that was a pretty amazing transformation. And now I look at th thistle patches as where I anticipate having the best grass in a few years
Interesting.
if I rotationally graze it correctly.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing this, I don't want to burn any of your sort of proprietary rotations, but how many cattle are you putting on what size of a land for how long? How are you getting water to these areas? Some of those sort of nuanced details for people that may be listening going, yeah, how do I tangibly, how does this look?
It has looked different for me every year. And
Okay.
yeah, I started out with cheap poly wire, and then I started buying better poly wire. And probably the as my transition happened, then I started to put high tensile steel fence. So my perimeter is all high tensile steel, and then I started to put a few intermediate high tensile steel paddocks. Intermediate fences inside the fields. And then I started buying truckloads of 300-foot rolls of 1-inch black poly tubing and put water lines underneath some of those fence lines from hydrants or water sources out into the field. We also installed a couple frost-free or fairly frost-free water systems in the fields in places. So we had to dig in a 2-inch line from the water source, the well or rural water, to get to those additional water sources.
Okay.
So that's kind of the infrastructure that I put into place. This year, early this summer, we transitioned to virtual fencing. So we have GPS collars on all of our cattle, and that has completely changed my infrastructure, internal infrastructure anyway. I'm tearing out all of the internal paddock fences and using that high tensile steel wire that I kind of harvest from that to bolster my exterior fence. And I'm putting more steel po or fence posts in my exterior fence because I had those spaced out a lot, but snow load and grass just has been pulling that fence down and breaking the insulators. And so I've been making fiberglass fence posts from 1¼-inch fiberglass sucker rod that's harvested from the oil fields. Chop it up, drill some holes in it, shove it in the ground, and use those. And they're insulative, so I don't need insulators. I can use just a wire to
Wow. Yeah.
steel fence to that. So that, in addition to the collars that I am like with my mama cow herd, I'm starting to transition a little bit more towards the kind of total grazing technique of
What do you
be real aggressive with grazing most of the forage, not just topping the grass, but trying to graze it like to within a couple inches of the ground and getting higher harvest utilization and longer rest periods. And so I move those cows 4 times a day, or I give them additional grass 4 times a day. But I can do that in like 7 minutes because I go on the computer and I click and I make these paddocks and I set up a schedule and it just happens automatically. And they move themselves basically to that new paddock.
How many are you putting on what size ground?
Right now I have 102 cows. About 80 of those have calves and about, well, probably 75 have calves and 25 are yearling heifers that are my breeding herd. So about 102 cows with 75 calves and I give them about 2 acres a day. So each break I'm giving them with the level of forage that's in that areas right now, I give them about a half an acre at 6 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and then 6 p.m. Fresh grass.
And then they won't see that paddock again for how long?
Well, they moving the back fence up is a little bit tricky, because if you move the back fence up too aggressively and the new paddock comes into play at a certain time and they're outside of the paddock, they're just free to go. So there's not like a one-way door. So I have to be pretty ginger with how I move up the back fence. So when they, you know, move on to new paddocks or get new grass the next day, I'm not back fencing them off of what they had the previous day for probably a week or a week and a half. Okay. But in reality, they don't spend much time on those old paddocks because they're just destroyed. And they move like a herd into those new paddocks quite a bit.
When Eric was talking about first training some of his herd on virtual fencing, he talked about putting them in a small, I think it was a 5-acre corral or pen with wire as a reinforcement and hay to kind of get them in there and get them used to it. And then as they sort of got more comfortable with the sound and the beeping and maybe the shock every now and then, they sort of dropped that and moved on. Is that the same sort of thing you had to do when you started to bring virtual fencing on, or did you use a different approach?
Nope, I used that exact same approach. So okay. I used a kind of a large rectangle with a water source on one end, and the virtual fencing that would give them about 2/3 of that rectangle, and, you know, hot wire fencing around the whole rectangle. And the first time they get to the virtual fence line, they don't know what that beep sound means. They don't know what the shock means or whatever. And so they just run around and bust through it and end up on the other side. And then the collar just turns itself off. So they go over beyond in that last third or whatever. And then eventually they come back to water. And then the next day they get to that line again. And after a few days, they learn what the deal is. And then they're set.
Gotcha. So it really, you can do it in a few days.
Assuming. Yeah, I think 3 or 4 days, provided they're already fairly docile cattle that know what a hot wire is and things like that. You know, not crazy Western, you know.
Right. Wild cows.
Wild.
I've heard of some of these other collars. Halter is a good one, a good example, where the beeping will be directional in such a way that it comes out of the left side if you want to turn the cows right, or it comes out the right side if you want to turn them left. I'm wondering if you, the ones you're employing have any of that sort of directional movement, or if it's just a beep that gets progressively louder or more frequent before the shock, something like that.
Interesting. I'm using the Gallagher East Shepherd collars.
Okay. Yep.
Is a high pitch like wee, and it happens. It's the same beep. It comes out of the front of a little speaker there, and so it is not directional. What I've found from the cows is that when they hear that, either from themselves or from their neighbor, because it's high pitched, it's hard to direction find that high pitched sound. Like all the cows just basically turn around and go back from where they came, wherever that is what they tend to do.
Yeah. Okay. And have you had any issues with, because these, I think, from what I've seen of other videos of that particular collar, they sort of hang, if you will, like a necklace. And then there's a pendulum or a something heavy at the middle, at the bottom. That's either the power or the processor, so to speak. Have you had any issues with these things coming off, or the cows will rub off the strap or something like that?
Yeah, Gallagher is probably the biggest collar with the thing, because it has a lithium ion battery and solar panels on the side. So you should not need to change the battery for the lifetime of the collar. So it's probably the largest device. And when I put them on, I thought I'm going to put these on as comfortable and loose as I possibly can without them getting them off. And that was a mistake. So I did have some of them, get them off, you know, rub them off, swing them off, something like that. But then the more unexpected thing was that with them being that loose and they had the ability to swing as much as they did, as they were grazing or just living, they would rock up and I think smack them on the bottom of the jaw. And they started to get sores on the bottom of their jaw and develop this kind of almost look like hanging skin with probably fluid underneath there, you know, some soreness. And so I basically had to get them all back in the chute and tighten up those collars. And now, instead of putting them on as loose as I could, just so they would stay on, I'm putting them on as tight as I can without choking them out.
Yeah.
And that I found to be a lot better fit for these particular collars.
Interesting. Would you ever go back to no virtual collars?
It would be really tough, because if I went back, I wouldn't be able to rotationally graze them as well as what I'm doing right now, because I can, you know, moving them four times a day, not a chance I could do that. That's all I would be doing, you know, and I can give them now a paddock that's long and narrow to get back to a water source. So I don't have to move my water sources as much as I did before. And so I would go back if I had to, but I would not choose to go back now if I could. Yeah, there are still some things for me to learn, for the technology to improve, but it has been a complete lifestyle change for me in having more time, the ability to look on my phone and see where all my cows are at all the time. You know, and not having to come over the hill towards my place and just look and hope my cattle aren't out on the road again. And so that peace of mind is really nice, especially if I want to be away from home. And I'm really excited about it. I think that as the technology improves, especially for rotational grazing and regenerative agriculture, I can't see these things not being widespread.
You don't have to give me prices on this, but can I ask what the business model is? If it's a hardware sale for the collar and then a subscription to maintain
different for every system. You know, a lot of them have a higher subscription for Gallagher E Shepherd. And I don't think it's a secret or anything like that. It's $350 a collar. If you just buy a handful, if you buy more than a certain amount, maybe 50 collars or something like that, it goes down to $250. And I think they have a tariff addition to it. It's like $265 or $270 per collar. Mm-hmm. And then it's a $2 per month subscription for the cell phone because they have a SIM card in them. So they work both off of cellular and GPS. If you don't have good cellular coverage in your area, then there's a base station that you need to put in. And that's like, I don't know, 10 grand or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. And you haven't had any issues with connectivity on your particular farm?
Not much. They're still getting the back end more robust. So we did have a couple days where their system was down and I could not communicate with the collars. Mm. So they were in the last left paddock, which I ended up having to bring them out hay because... I mean, they didn't even have access to a corral at that point. So there was no way I could even get the collars off of them if I needed to. And so we were kind of stuck. So I ended up having to bring them hay. But that's really the only hiccup that's happened.
Even with the rotational grazing that they're doing now, do you have like a perennial grass in there that they can eat during the winter, or do you still have to feed during the winter?
We'll see. I'm doing things a lot different this year. I've like Cortez, I've burned my ships this year, I feel like. And my ships are getting tired of being burned because it seems like I'm doing that every year. But the 350 or 500 acres of row crop ground that I had as a survival technique in like 2017 or 16, when I was doing more guard stuff, we planted it all to alfalfa, and I had a neighbor hay that alfalfa and market it to local dairies as my cash crop. So then I sold my combine, wasn't doing row crops in the spring, really relieved a lot of that seasonal work. And And this year, I took the last of my ground out of that cash crop alfalfa ground. I didn't like what that was doing to the soil structure. My water infiltration is not good. Like monocrop alfalfa, taking five cuttings a year does
It's
not
rough.
is not regenerative to your soil.
Right.
So I've basically cut off my income stream, and now I've got all this alfalfa ground that I've got to figure out how to utilize that well. Even though I'm now with all that, I'm understocked with my 100 head of cattle that's been growing, and so I've been working on ways to plant forage crops into a perennial alfalfa stand, which is challenging, especially in the spring when alfalfa is growing like crazy. What I found is that I have to go through it with a like a buffalo till cultivator or an old cultivator that has sweeps on it just to shear off the roots in at least a strip in there. And then if I do that and I plant in something that has a lot of vertical development later on and grows fairly fast, then it can get up above the alfalfa before the alfalfa comes out with both arms swinging.
Yeah, it chokes
So
it.
sorghum sedan grass mix with millets and a bunch of other stuff has been what I've been employing there and experimenting with this year. So I've got this crazy 30-way mix from Green Cover Seed, sorghum sedan grass, a few different types of that, a few different types of millet, turnips, radishes, sunflowers, buckwheat, flax, anything that was termed good or excellent for like summer mix, I put in there just to have, and some of it just very small amounts, just to have a lot of diversity. Cabbage, kale,
Wow.
different things. And I drilled that into this alfalfa stand after I had gone through it with that cultivator. And it grew up like crazy. 6, 7 feet tall, sunflower sticking out the top. And so I've been rotationally grazing my finishers through that. And I've been on a quest to be able to get good standing as well as stored feed for my finishers to give them the energy necessary to put on intermuscular fat fast to get a good eating experience out of those grass finishers.
Interesting. So you're going to have the plan is to have those finishers there on that acreage through the winter.
Yes, it is. And then also some of that acreage that my finishers have already grazed through once or twice and continues to regrow until it gets frosted off, which it just kind of is right now. Once the prussic acid is kind of washed out of that frosted off sorghum sand grass, then I'll bring the mama cow herd in to just clean up everything because I don't push
Wow.
finishers to clean stuff up like I do my finishing cow or my cow calf herd. So
Yeah.
the area that my finishers are on right now, after probably a month from now, I'm going to transition them to another area that is sorghum sedan grass mix, really thick, that is freezing off, and I will graze them through that. And then I'll bring my mama cow herd over to where my finishers are right now. And for my finishers, I do what I call intensive rotational feeding. So I'm rotationally grazing them, but I'm also providing them balage in a mobile bale feeder,
Okay.
like baled and wrapped alfalfa and winter rye, that is baled wet and wrapped in plastic. And then it
Whoa.
and ferments to like a silage pile or a
Yeah.
food silo. And then we're able to harvest that at the peak of its energy and give them the energy and it's actually acetic acid is the acid that forms when winter rye ferments. That's the same acid that's in apple cider vinegar, and it's the same acid that's in the rumen. About 70% of the acid in rumen is acetic acid. So it ends up, I think, being a little bit of a probiotic. And so the last few years, I've spiked in winter rye into the alfalfa after the fifth cutting. And then in the spring, when that alfalfa and winter rye grows up together, then I've baled and wrapped that, or had my neighbor bale and wrap that. And I've started feeding that to my finishers. And I've really seen a corner turned with the timeline to get them to finish, the amount of intermuscular fat, and the lack of kind of a gamey taste and texture and smell.
Wow. How how much weight are you looking to put on these finishers, and in what time frame before you send them off to get processed?
My goal is to put on 2.5 pounds per day for their lifetime so that I can calf in April and May and have them to 1400 pound finishing weight by Thanksgiving.
Holy cow. These are Angus?
Yes. Black and red Angus. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And how close are the finishers on that crop land now before you send them out?
Say that again.
The finishers that are on there now, how close are they to being processed?
The ones that I have right now that I just drove through this morning are about ready to be processed right now.
What's the number of those? How many?
I have the steers that I have is just about 19.
Okay. And you've got a local processor you're using?
We had somebody build across the road from our house, and we were kind of disappointed about seeing, you know, a house go up or something like that in the alfalfa field across the road from our house. My wife went out to meet them as they were putting the stakes in the ground, and the guy came up to talk to my wife, and he was actually a former Air Force intel troop, and he loves butchering, and they put up a butcher shop across the road from our house.
Oh my gosh.
Where I was like, okay, Lord, we were tossing around doing the direct marketing thing, mm-hmm. and we're like, I don't know how much more clear God could be with us than putting a butcher shop literally from my mailbox. I can hit their mailbox across the road. You know, like my kids can watch from our kitchen window, me back up to the chute there. So yeah, it's unbelievable having it that close.
God is great. And sometimes like those areas, yeah. What's their capacity?
They do about, I think maybe 2 animals a day or something like that. Beef animals. So I think 8-10 animals beef a week is their capacity. And I think that's mostly driven on the size of their cooler. You know, they sure. Have space to hang much more than that.
But that sounds like it's perfect for you, unless they've got 10 other farms that they're serving.
No, it's perfect for me. This year I will have processed 28 animals there. Okay.
And then you're selling direct to consumer through an e-commerce channel on your website. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And after people visit the website, or actually most of them just get word of mouth. And then they just text me, hey, I want a quarter. And we just do transactions that way through text and then the beef.
I saw something on your website that had a nutrient profile for omega-6 and omega-3 ratios. Have you actually had your beef tested for nutrient composition? And if so, what were you comparing it to? Traditional?
Good question. So backing up, when I first got cattle, I was not excited about grass finishing. I wanted to get grass-fed genetics because I thought they would finish faster and better and just be more efficient overall. Mm-hmm. And so that's what made me pursue the genetic strain that I have that is kind of in a roundabout way through Nebraska from the Farrell Cattle Company in Colorado.
Okay.
Farrell. They've been working on grass-fed genetics for a number of years. But then as I was continuing to research animal health and then human health, the omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio just kept coming up and realizing where those omega-6 fatty acids come from. And then that education kind of herded me towards grass finishing. So that's what made me go towards that direction. We homeschool our kids. We're part of a homeschool co-op in Sioux Falls. And I met the grandfather of one of the other homeschool kids there. And turns out he has a company in Sioux Falls, like a world-renowned company that studies omega fatty acids in human health. And so studying and testing beef meat for fatty acids is not really a part of their wheelhouse, but he kind of humored me. And I gave him a few of our samples, and I gave him some meat from a large box store. You know, your standard 80-20 ground beef, like the cheapest stuff I could find, and had the omega-6s and omega-3s and omega-9s all measured in there. And it took me a while to read the report because it was all in kind of molecular terms and things that I didn't quite understand until I Googled it. But I added up all the omega-6s, added up all the omega-3s, did the ratio, and our ratio came out to omega-6 to 3 ratio of 0.8 to 1 and 0.9 to 1. So we actually had more omega-3s than omega-6s by just a small amount. And
And
the beef from the supermarket was 9.8 to 1. So 10 times as much omega-6s as omega-3s. And that was like, wow, this is really amazing.
is it that the six is bad or just less ideal or less bioavailable than the three?
So omega-6s and omega-3s are called essential fatty acids. They're both fatty acids that animals and people don't produce in their bodies. They need to consume, and we need both of them. But we need them in a ratio, a balanced ratio. And it turns out omega-6 to omega-3s, they think the best balance of that is about a one-to-one.
That's really interesting. You don't normally hear of producers like yourselves going down that deep into the rabbit hole of looking at the nutrient composition of your product. But it does tell me that you're sort of ahead of this early wave, I think, that's coming around people wanting to understand and putting more, hopefully, premium in the protein that they're buying as being more nutrient dense than the same protein that they would buy at Walmart or Costco or whatever or Myers.
Since the first round of testing, we've found Audacious Food Lab in Massachusetts. And they started a food lab much at the behest of the coordination between them and Dan Kittredge's BioNutrient Food Association, or BioNutrient Food Institute. And they are doing a very deep dive into a bunch of different foods and their nutrient density and how to measure them, hopefully at the point of sale, so that you can have a handheld device that can, at the
Oh,
supermarket,
wow.
measure the nutrient content of this carrot versus this carrot, which is going to completely revolutionize the way people shop and use their consumer dollar. And I'm really excited
Incredible.
about that. But that's where I found Eric Smith and his Audacious Food Lab. And so that's now where we send, and we've sent another couple rounds of meat to them. And we still are in the 1.2 to 1, 1 to 1, right where we want to be. But we'll continue to test that, because as I now graze my animals through this sorghum Sudan grass mix and these different things, I want to see how that is reflected in the nutrient content. You know, we can taste and see what happens for the eating experience. And that's honestly, that's a bigger challenge with grass-fed beef, I think, than getting the nutritional side down, is getting something that's highly nutrient dense and a good eating experience.
A brief aside before I want to give you something anecdotal from my own experiences. You mentioned your kids are homeschooled through a co-op. Do you mind if I ask what co-op you're using?
Classical Conversations.
The same one we've been using since my oldest was 4. He's now 15. I've got four boys, so we've been doing it for all four of them for the better part of 11 years or so. It's wonderful.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
I thought when you said that, and then you mentioned a community in Sioux Falls, I was like, I wonder if that's what he's using. Okay, brief aside there. And you have six kids?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. So big family there as well. Awesome. I want to just put those two dots together because I thought that some of that might be the case. Our own anecdotal experience. We've got a small herd of Piney Woods cattle in Northeast Texas. It's an Agricola sort of heritage Spanish breed. They look a lot like Longhorns. Their horns don't go quite out as far. They're a little shorter in base and they come out a little straighter. It's a lean animal, right? It's a grass-fed animal.
Okay.
They forage as much down as they do up, right? So they'll eat pine needles, they'll eat oak leaves, they'll eat sweet gum leaves. I mean, they're a piney wood. Yeah, it's like a goat in cow form in a lot
Okay.
of ways, right? So we've processed two so far ourselves. We have a third that we're about to do. We had very low expectations for what these cattle were going to taste like, right? Because they're a very lean breed. There's no grain involved. We certainly don't go through the same rigor that you just described. But we noticed two things, right? We noticed that their flesh is bright red. It doesn't have this like pink hue to it. There's not a ton of intermuscular fat, right? The ribeyes look more like strips than they do ribeyes, but they're no less, they still have a very good eating experience, right? They're not chewy. You know, they don't have the marbling that you would see for the ribeye at the store, but that doesn't necessarily affect the way that it tastes. So that was a pleasant surprise. The other thing that was a pleasant surprise is that prior to us sort of harvesting our own cows, we had done just regular ground beef, right, and tacos and things like that. And you feel different after you eat a couple of tacos with store-bought ground beef. For me in particular, it makes your stomach a little upset. You feel kind of achy the next morning. It just doesn't sit well. You eat that same amount of tacos with this beef, and you don't feel any of that. And so I just share that anecdotally to see if your customers have come back to you and said, not only does this taste different, but we potentially feel different after we eat it as well. Has any of that come back to you?
The feeling different, I haven't had a lot of feedback on that. I've had a lot of really good feedback on the taste and texture of our beef. We had one guy who was he was traveling with his truck and camper that he was living in from like Florida to Montana or something, and he just found us on the internet and he stopped by and bought like a quarter or an eighth of beef or something like
Ha
that. And he picked it up. You know, he was coming through. I usually have people come on Friday afternoon, so this afternoon I'll have people coming. But he picked it up on like a Saturday or something. And he was a really interesting guy, a really neat guy to talk to. And Sunday morning on our way to church, I got a phone call from him. And I was like, oh, I better see what this is. And he was like, what is with those steaks? And I thought at first, I was like, oh, I'm gonna have to be returning this guy. He doesn't like him. I'm gonna have to buy him back or something like that. But no, he was just like, what in the world are you doing with the steaks? Like, that was just such a unique, pleasant experience. He just was completely blown away by that. And the more we go on now, the more marbling and things like that that we're getting. I had a really nice experience with a gentleman just south of me who came up to advise me on composting. So he's a kind of nationally known composter and expert in bacteria and fungi and Elaine Ingham type stuff. And he came out to do some advising for me on the farm, and he was willing to take beef as acceptable payment. He was excited to take beef as a payment for that. And he's in the regenerative agriculture space, but he's never been happy with 100% grass-fed meat. So they've been buying grass-fed, grain-finished meat just to get the good eating experience. And he has a lab. He tests stuff, looks at stuff under a microscope. So this guy is good into experimentation, data keeping, and things like that. And so he did some side-by-side trials of our ribeyes and New York strips versus the stuff that they'd been eating. And he commented that the eating experience on ours was about the same. They did like double blind taste tests or whatever, and they still slightly preferred the grain finished stuff, but not by much. And he said that that experience has completely changed his thought of what completely grass-fed, grass-finished beef could be. So that was a really, really nice compliment.
And as you start to get this product out there, you said most of your inbound inquiries comes from word of mouth.
It is now. Yeah. I mean,
Wow.
I've done a few, sitting in a booth here at the homeschool conference or whatever. I don't think I've had anybody come as a result of that. People stumble upon our website, just Googling grass-fed beef. That's one way people come. But more often than not, it is folks in our homeschool community or the community of their community. Word of mouth is now starting to get us the most business.
Well, that's awesome, Carl. To the extent that this helps do that, I can hope that this helps move more folks towards what you're doing. I've taken up an inordinate amount of your time today, so thank you so much for just being candid and full of energy and salt of the earth and insightful. I really think it will resonate with other veterans as they think about what opportunities are available for them in agriculture, and just the rigor through which you've made this switch and jumped in headfirst, like many military members tend to do. In a final sort of question, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that I should have, from your experiences or anything like that?
It has, you know, going back to kind of the military thread, it has been really nice to transition to this career where I really feel a calling and it's not an eternal purpose, you know, like, but being able to figure out how to feed people nutritious food is just gives a lot of job satisfaction. Whereas some of my peers end up doing other jobs that pay a lot more, but don't give that kind of sense of meaning and purpose. They have a lot of money, but not much meaning and purpose in their actual occupation. And I have the complete polar opposite. If I had to choose one, I'd choose the one that I have right now. So that's been a real blessing. I really appreciate, and I feel a little bit unworthy of the level of financial compensation I've been given, both in my career as well as in retirement. I feel like what I've been paid is too good for what I did, but not good enough for what I was willing to do. And I wasn't called to do or demanded to do what I was willing to do very often. I still feel a little bit of a patriotic duty, or a duty to the folks that are paying my bills, my retirement and things like that now, to try to help pioneer and break the way for food that's healthy enough to be considered medicine and tastes really good too. So hopefully we can try to revolutionize agriculture, as I think we are being set up right now with MAHA and just the general public's interest in this. I think we have a window of opportunity that we really need to capitalize on and put both hands to the plow.
Yeah, 100% agree. This sense of purpose that you described comes up almost every conversation, right? As veterans begin to find that, even if it doesn't always and often end up in financial, you know, freedom or incredible
right.
wealth, the sense of purpose they get from it far outweighs that. The other thing that comes up regularly is that many veterans still feel this sense of service, right? And in many cases, they serve multiple times, right? They serve their country in the military, and then they serve their country again as producers, right? And so that never really, you can take, right, the service member out of the service, but you can't take their sense of service away. And
yep.
Listening to you kind of describe that at the end is something that resonates a lot as well in these conversations. Carl, where can folks find your product? Where can they learn more about what you guys are doing at Sunlight and Rain if they're interested?
Yep. Our website, sunlightandrain.com, is probably the quickest, easiest way to get your first view into that. And then our phone number's on there. We're not big enough now to where it's arduous. If you just give me a call, I usually am able to stop what I'm doing and have a conversation. And then when people come out to pick up beef, we usually end up having a conversation about it as well.
That's a wrap on today's conversation with Carl Palmberg. It's clear that his journey from the cockpit to the cattle pasture is a testament to resilience, service, and a relentless pursuit of purpose. Carl's story reminds us that finding meaning in the work we do, whether it's defending a nation or regenerating land, can be the greatest reward, far beyond any financial gain. His commitment to innovation and stewardship serves as an inspiring example to veterans exploring new opportunities in agriculture. For those interested in learning more or connecting with Carl, you can find him directly on LinkedIn, or you can check out their website at sunlightandrain.com, where a spirit of service continues to shape both the soil and the lives it sustains.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSau, and until next time, stay frosty.